From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the year 1200 in England. For a moment, imagine yourself as a time traveler and you're tasked with this mission. You have to convince the English people in the year 1200 that white people deserve the right to vote. What is a white person anyway? Maybe it's easy for you to answer that now in the year 2017, but it would have been a strange one in the year 1200. And there's a reason we're posing this idea. I've stolen this thought experiment from a presentation given by Paul Chappell, who is an Iraq War veteran, and a lot more we'll tell you in a moment. But Paul's larger point is the way we have, over time, dehumanized others, but also this. We are making progress as a human race. We are slowly moving away from the denial of rights, the dehumanization, dispossession, subjugation. All of that builds to a larger question. Can we ever make enough progress to eliminate war? Or do you think that war is some part of the human condition that will always be there in some way? Chappell believes that's a myth, that war is inevitable and that world peace is impossible. He says it's possible. He's in Rochester today as a guest at the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence. But first, he is my guest on Connections, and his full title, I want to give it to you, because imagine this is your role. Peace Leadership Director of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. Just an absolutely remarkably important effort. And Paul, thank you for being here. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kit Miller is the director of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence, and Paul has a busy schedule. You want to tell us what's already happened and what's coming up over today and tomorrow?
Sure, Evan. Thank you. We just finished an opportunity earlier today at the University of Rochester to and worked, Paul presented to about 150 or so young high school students from more than 20 countries that are visiting Rochester this week. And later on today, we'll be at Downtown United Presbyterian Church at 7 o'clock, an event co-sponsored, a talk co-sponsored by Downtown United Presbyterian Church and the Pachamama Alliance.
So if you want to see Paul, you can do that tonight, 7 p.m.?
That's right.
7 p.m. tonight. And I'm curious to know, Kit, before we start talking to Paul about this super important and fascinating question to me about whether war and strife is inevitable, how did you first hear about Paul? I'm always curious to know how the Gandhi Institute connects with people like Paul. You don't remember, do you? Look at you. Did I stump you?
It's been it was years ago. I think I read one of Paul's early books. And his scholarship is impeachable. His training...
Unimpeachable is probably what you meant.
But that's right. Thank you very much. I was just testing to see if you were paying attention.
I'm paying attention.
No more impeachment talk on the show today.
No.
Yes, his scholarship, the background of attending West Point and then serving in Iraq, and also the authenticity with which he shares his own really amazing and challenging life journey all captured me years ago, and it's a pleasure to see him again here in Rochester.
Paul, I'm encouraged in watching some of your presentations online, and I hope people will be encouraged by your message today, but let me start with a note of pessimism, because you've heard it all, right? So one of my favorite podcasts is Radiolab, and their season 6, they did a program on, you know, sort of whether human beings kind of can change and how we evolve. And they called it the new normal. And one of the segments of the new normal, they went out on the streets of Hoboken and they were just talking to people about their views on whether war is inevitable. John Horgan was a reporter. He was sitting there in 2003. The Iraq War is going on. He found that in an audience of 60 people, there had been a presentation, and he asked people, 60 people in the audience, 2003, how many people believe that war will ever end one day? There will be no more war. Of the 60 people in the audience, one or two raised their hands. He went out on the streets. He asked people, you know, what do you think? And they talked to many, many people. On average, 9 out of 10 people said there will always be war. And usually they said it's because it's the human condition. Here are some examples. Quote, I think there's a human nature of always wanting more and being greedy. Another one, quote, it's in our genes. Another one, it's too ingrained in our human nature. You've heard all of that. Then I thought of Pete Dupre, who's a 94-year-old World War II veteran. They call him Harmonica Pete. He's one of the sweetest people I've met. We had him on the program a couple of months ago. He says he is an optimist. He is not one of these greatest generation folks who thinks, well, kids these days are lazy. He doesn't think that. But he is a pessimist about war. And I want to listen to what Pete Dupre told me about his fear that there will always be war. Here's what Pete said.
I don't like the way things are going at all. Not that I can control it, but I see repeating.
History
things.
Repeating?
Yeah, yeah. unlearned history.
What's an example of that, Pete?
They do something. They don't do something. I guess that's a crazy way to answer your question, but there's always some they, and you got to go get they because they're not doing it the way it's supposed to be done. And so what do? Well, then you go shoot them.
That's 94-year-old Pete Dupre, and I thought that was a beautiful way of just describing the way we dehumanize and we otherize people. To him, it's just the word they. But he's 94, and he's worried. He was in World War II. Here he is in 2017 thinking we haven't learned our lessons. So that's the backdrop of the pessimism. You're here with the optimism. Why are you an optimist on the human condition in war?
Yeah, so I think that I'm really glad you brought up the pessimism, by the way. Where I primarily look is if you actually look at military history, you see this very interesting paradox where if you look around the world looks flat, but it's not actually flat. And it looks like the sun revolves around the earth, but it doesn't actually revolve around the earth. If you just look on the surface, it does look like war is inevitable and it's human nature. But if you actually look deeply into military history, you realize something very fascinating, that humans actually are not naturally violent. We're not naturally warlike. And you learn how the system is created and recreated through different generations. Just to give you a couple of examples, the greatest problem of every army in world history is, when a battle begins, how do you stop soldiers from running away? If you look at our fight or flight response, most people's natural reaction when you try to stab them or shoot them is to run away as fast as they can, as far as they can. And just to give a modern example, think about mass shootings. How do the vast majority of people react when they're in the vicinity of a mass shooting? Most people, they run, they're panicking, they're screaming, there's people running outdoors, some people are jumping out windows. After the mass shooting, people are traumatized, people are crying. Some people might have to go to therapy, and that's just one person with a gun shooting up an area. And if I pull out a knife and charge at somebody, most people's reaction is actually to get away from me. And so the other thing is that what does war do to the human brain? War traumatizes the human brain. This is so non-controversial today that even pro-war people today will say that war is hell. So if human beings are naturally violent, why would war traumatize the human brain? If we were naturally violent, why wouldn't people go to war and become more mentally healthy? And so what percent of American men have served in the U.S. military post 9/11? Very, very few. How many famous rappers, basketball players, athletes, rock stars, politicians, Silicon Valley CEOs have joined the military to fight in these wars? If men had this natural desire to fight in war, there'd be many more men signing up. And of course, the military and the U.S. government has to frame war as something other than war. We're fighting for freedom. We're fighting for democracy. We're fighting to protect our way of life, GI Bill, college money, all these incentives that really aren't about war to get people to join the military. So that's just kind of a quick overview of how things that at first seem very certain. If you look at, for example, the Iliad, the oldest war epic ever written, almost 3,000 years old, one of the most fascinating things about the Iliad is that the soldiers in the Iliad, they don't really want to be there. So when King Agamemnon, at the beginning of the Iliad, he tries to test his soldiers' courage. He says he's going to play a trick on them. He's going to tell them to all retreat back to the ships and to sail home just to see how their warrior spirit is at that moment. He says that the soldiers just stampede to the ships. And there's all these examples in the Iliad where the men have to, they need all these appeals to fight. For example, we have this natural desire to eat or to drink water or to sleep. And we have this natural desire to eat, drink, and sleep. And it's such a natural, important urge that you will actually pay people money if they will give you food. You will pay people money for water. You will pay people money if they give you a place to sleep. The military actually has to pay people money so they will go to war. So in the Iliad, soldiers have to be given all these appeals. They're fighting for their family. They have to be offered money. They have to swear an oath to keep people on the battlefield. And without those kinds of appeals, people will just want to leave and go back home where they're much safer.
We're kind of working backwards through a Chautauqua presentation, but I think this is a great way to do it because when you think about what Paul just said here, for those of us who haven't served, isn't that fascinating that one of the biggest challenges is to keep soldiers on the battlefield? That when we see an act of heroism, of a man on a train who stopped a knife attack, it's heroism simply because that person was brave enough to ignore their impulse not to fight, exactly. not to be violent. But here's where the cynics, or at least I think here's a fair question, a rejoinder to that. What you're describing is in-the-moment violence. And when people are in the moment, they don't want to be the victims of violence. They don't want to suffer physical pain. They don't want to die. The reason war might be inevitable is because we have such inegalitarianism, that we have such structural inequality, that we will always have people in control of large populations that can dictate behavior and action enough so that even against our own desires, we will make war to sort of appease the whims of nation states, leaders, etc. So it's not necessarily about in the moment of violence, but it's about the way human beings structure societies and inevitably how that leadership behaves.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And how do, for example, the way that leadership behaves, they often present war as being something about other than what it is really about, where if a government wants to go to war for economic gain, they don't frame it that way. They say they're fighting for some sort of noble ideal.
Well, they used to. They used to say it that way, right?
Right.
Which is one of the things Paul points out in his presentation that I watched, which is how interesting that we have to start euphemizing for violence over time.
Right.
You know. So anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I'll just address a couple things very quickly. I don't think history is repeating itself. I don't think that's what is happening. I've heard many people say, well, the U.S. government didn't learn anything from the Vietnam War. If the U.S. government would have learned from the Vietnam War, we would have never gone to war in Iraq. Actually, the U.S. government learned a lot from the Vietnam War. And the U.S. government learned so much from the Vietnam War that that is precisely why we went into war in Iraq. So the U.S. government learned four primary things from the Vietnam War. First of all, it learned, get rid of the draft. Most important lesson, because most people do not want to go to war. And this is, again, why throughout human history, armies draft men to fight in wars. And when armies get rid of their draft, most rich men do not want to go to war anymore. And when rich men do want to go to war, war is usually framed in some sort of noble context. So number one, get rid of the draft. Number two, embed journalists in military units. Number three, privatize the military to the greatest extent possible. And number four, tell people if they don't support the war, they don't support the troops. And then the U.S. government learned again from the Iraq War. There was a great public outcry about the issue of dead U.S. soldiers. And so the U.S. government has moved a lot more towards the use of drones. And they want to, in the future, also move toward ground-based drones. Because when you have a drone fighting a war either from the air or from the ground, you have less U.S. casualties. So the war system is constantly adapting, and the systems of dehumanization are constantly adapting. We still have dehumanization today, but it is a much different kind than what we would have seen 100 years ago. For example, if you go back 100 years, in World War I, there was a British propaganda poster depicting a German soldier as a guerrilla. In World War II, there's an official U.S. government propaganda poster depicting a Japanese soldier as a rat. In World War II, there was an official Japanese government leaflet depicting a British soldier as a wolf. And those forms of dehumanization would not work today. If you had a poster of a German as a gorilla, people wouldn't fall for that today. Because humanity is making progress, it is harder to dehumanize people now than it was 100 years ago. As a result, the propaganda today has become much more sophisticated than it was 100 years ago. So prior to the Iraq invasion of 2003, American politicians would basically say, look, the Iraqi people are just like us. They are just like us. They want freedom. They want democracy. They want a better way of life for them and their children. And these poor, suffering people are living under this evil dictator. Don't we have a moral obligation to liberate them from this evil dictator? And American politicians would basically say, look at these Afghan women. They're just like our women. They're like our mothers, our sisters, our wives, our daughters. They want education, democracy, freedom. Don't we have a moral obligation to liberate them from the evil Taliban? And don't get me wrong, people suffered terribly under Saddam Hussein. They're suffering terribly under the Taliban. But of course, the U.S. government supported Saddam Hussein through all his worst atrocities. And we currently are allied with one of the most oppressive governments in the world toward women, the Saudi Arabian government. So the point I'm trying to make here is that history is actually not repeating itself in the way we think. What is happening is we are making advances in terms of not dehumanizing people and having a more negative attitude toward war. And the systems that perpetuate war and dehumanization are actually evolving and becoming more sophisticated to counteract that advancement.
That optimism is important because right alongside it is the fact that weaponization is more advanced than ever before, and that many of us have the fear that if a nuclear device goes off in a major world population center, all of this progress goes out the window. And we're going to see reprisal, and we're going to see terrible, terrible events. And that's why Paul does give me a lot of hope. My guest is Paul Chappell, who is Peace Leadership Director of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. He's an Iraq War veteran and an author, and he is here in Rochester today as a guest of the Gandhi Center for Nonviolence. And let's talk about your own background and some of your credentials to talk about these subjects, Paul, because, you know, when we talk about dehumanization, you and your own family, your own parents have had messages for your own background of identity and who you are and what opportunity is. And I think for you personally, that has certainly, it seems to have played into how you perceive the question of dehumanization and then how you look at historical perspectives. So why don't you tell me a little bit more about your background?
Yes, thank you. So my own background, I grew up in a very violent household. My father fought in the Korean and Vietnam Wars. He had a lot of war trauma. And I developed a lot of behavioral problems as a child because of that violent upbringing. So I got kicked out of elementary school for fighting, almost got kicked out of middle school, got suspended in high school for fighting. And I grew up with very strong feelings of alienation, some bullying, because my mother's Korean, my father's half white and half black, and I grew up in Alabama. And when I was in high school, the alienation rage I had been feeling started to become very extreme. And when I was in high school, I badly wanted to join a violent extremist group. And one reason why I never joined the violent extremist group is because back then, there was no violent extremist group that would take somebody who's part black, part Asian, and part white. And so one reason why I got interested in peace is because I wanted to figure out, how do you protect human societies from people like me? People who have suffered from extreme childhood trauma, people whose preferred method of expression is rage and violence. And so when I talk about humans not being naturally violent, I'm not saying people can't become violent, but we have to view violence the way we view illness. Illness is very common, but if somebody gets cancer or HIV or diabetes or malaria, nobody ever says, oh, that's human nature. People realize something has gone wrong. How do we fix this? So when people become violent, we should see it kind of like illness. Something has gone wrong in human development, and how do we fix this? And my own life experience has also contributed to my awareness of this, because I can very easily see, I was going down that mentality of like a mass shooter. And so it's very easy for me to just go into this whole different kind of mental state where I think it's very dangerous. And I think it's actually becoming a more common phenomenon that people are experiencing today.
You felt that strongly.
Yeah, I can become so enraged, I'm just almost insane. So for me, figuring out how to control my interest in peace initially was, how do I control my rage? How do I heal my trauma? How do I interact with people in a peaceful way? Because I realize I'm eventually going to kill somebody. I don't get angry. Growing up, I didn't get angry the way most people would get angry. The ways I would get angry were really, really extreme compared to how most people would get angry because of the way I was raised.
I was struck by something you said at Chautauqua. You said, in all of human history, there has never been an incident in which a human being was traumatized from receiving a genuine act of kindness.
Yeah.
And my first reaction to that is profound. That if we think about all of the people who struggle with trauma, how often that leads to violence, or how often someone who is violent has experienced trauma, and how interconnected those things are, that's profound. Again, the pessimist will say, but there will always be trauma.
Yeah.
And is that too pessimistic for you?
I think there will always be trauma. I think there will always be violence. I think there will always be murder. With 7 billion people on the planet, you can't get rid of all murder. You can't get rid of all trauma. War is a much different machine than interpersonal violence, because war requires huge amounts of money, national consent, industries, propaganda systems. So if we get rid of war, I'm not saying that there's not going to be murder or assault
or violence,
trauma.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
But war is it requires huge amounts of resources and propaganda to support as a system. And I think we could abolish war but still have murder and violence. And we can also make progress on reducing violence, reducing trauma, reducing murder. But I think with 7 billion plus people on the planet, you're always going to have somebody out there who wants to kill somebody.
So I want to do two things as we work through the rest of the hour here. Remind you that Paul Chappell is here, and we're talking about his feeling that war is not simply part of the human condition, that world peace is possible, that war is not inevitable. So what are the actual causes of war? We're going to talk about that a little bit more in our second half hour. And I want to work back through some of those historical examples and those thought experiments that I thought were so valuable, that when you go back to 1200 England and you talk about what being white means, if, for people who are so concerned about how we still have racism, inequality, racism, deep, deep racism, not just on the personal level, but structural and all the different kinds of ways that it manifests. Paul is not here to say that that doesn't exist, but his historical examples do, at least for me, provide that framework of hope, that sometimes when we get so down on that, the way we otherize, that, boy, it used to be even more so in really violent ways. So we're going to be doing that for the rest of the hour, but I can also tell you that if you want to call the program or weigh in any way, 844-295-TALK, it's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Do you think war is part of the human condition? I mean, again, Paul said no, and he's not here to argue with you, but he's here to help you think of it in different ways. And so let's kind of go back here a little bit, and let's talk about historically. You know, you ask people to think about what it would be like in 1200 to think about what whiteness means. I mean, for people today, it probably means something that's, you know, it probably means something roughly the same for most of our listeners in this audience right now.
Yeah.
But that wouldn't have been the case hundreds of years ago. Tell me why you wanted to bring that up.
Yeah, so I bring that up to show people that for most of human history, racism was not based on skin color. Racism has been around for at least 2,500 years, longer than that probably, but we have recorded history showing racism at least as early as the 5th century BC. But it was never based on skin color. It was based on location. So racism that the Greeks would have toward non-Greeks, same skin color. Racism that the English would have toward the Irish, same skin color. Racism between French and Germans, same skin color. Racism that the Japanese have toward the Koreans, same skin color. Even if you look at tribal issues, for example, in the Rwandan genocide, the racism that the Hutus had toward the Tutsis, same skin color. Racism based on skin color is less than 600 years old. And this also shows how this is manufactured. And the role-playing scenarios I do in terms of try to convince a group of English people in 1200 that all white men should have the right to vote, and you first have to convince them that there's such a thing as white people. And then I do a role-playing scenario about convincing a Christian church in 1600 or 1700 that slavery is always wrong. And if I control the time period of the role-playing scenario, you can't win the argument. And then I show that just as those...
Let's do this. Yeah. Give me an example. Work me through this the same way you did that audience, because I find this really interesting.
So an example I give is, imagine going back to Harvard in the year 1800. You're talking to a Harvard class, and your mission is to convince this Harvard class in 1800 that all women should have the right to vote.
And it's 1800.
1800.
Okay.
Harvard class in the year 1800. You're a time traveler. And I say, in the year 1800, women in America cannot vote, they can't own property, they can't go to college, they can't serve on a jury, and a man can legally beat and rape his wife. Also, in the year 1800, a lot of white men don't have the right to vote because there are certain property requirements. And so we don't have women's rights everywhere today. But wherever you find a lack of women's rights today, you will find a women's rights movement. Today, there is a women's rights movement in Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan. If you go back 300 years, there was not a single women's rights movement anywhere in the world asking for full political, social, economic equality. So in 1800, women could not vote in any country on the planet. By 1970, women could vote in over 100 countries.
But I can do this. It's 1800, right?
Yes. I'm a Harvard class, and you're a time traveler.
Listen, women are intellectually equal to men here, and the idea that women, half of our population or slightly more, would be subjugated in this way is beneath us. And that, my goodness, you're Harvard. You're supposed to be the ivory tower, the elite here. You should lead by example and honor women in that way.
Yeah. So example I would give is that back then people believed this myth that women are intellectually inferior to men. And that was a very common myth. And today we know it is scientifically true. Women are not intellectually inferior to men. Today, women in America graduate college at higher rates than men do. But let's fast forward to the 1870s. 70 years after 1800, Charles Darwin wrote a book called The Descent of Man. And Charles Darwin says, obviously, men are smarter than women. Charles Darwin says, look at the greatest achievements in any field. They're all men. Isaac Newton, Copernicus, Galileo, Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, Bach, Mozart, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates. If you go to the East, Lao Tzu, Buddha, Confucius, they're all men. Now, of course—
And this is Charles Darwin, making this argument.
Charles Darwin believed women are biologically inferior to men intellectually in the 1870s, and he's not a stupid person.
No, this is not like a Pepe the Frog guy on Twitter.
Right, right. This is Charles Darwin. Yeah. And of course, Charles Darwin missed this very obvious logical flaw that, well, women weren't allowed to do those things. How do you know whether women are intellectually equal or not if they're forbidden from those endeavors?
They're not even allowed to do it.
Right.
And therefore, they're not capable. Charles Darwin.
And then I reference a professor at Harvard Medical School named Edward Clark. In the 1870s, this professor at Harvard Medical School, Edward Clark, said that when women study, it damages their health. And when women become educated, their ovaries don't develop and they can't reproduce. And Edward Clark said that—
Am I allowed to laugh at that?
Yeah. When people laugh at that, I say, that sounds funny to us, and he's a professor at Harvard Medical School. What if there are things that we believe today that are going to sound funny in the future?
I love that question.
Yeah.
I love that question. What are our commonly held beliefs that future generations will look back and be like, right, women's ovaries do not stop developing when they read a book? You know,
right.
That's not somebody who is just picked off the street. That's one of the elite educational leaders in the 19th century.
Yeah, so to give an example is Frederick Douglass, of course, lived in Rochester. In the 1840s, Frederick Douglass said that a woman should be allowed to have any job a man can have. In the 1840s, Frederick Douglass was advocating women's right to vote, full women's political, social, economic equality. Frederick Douglass had no formal education. There was an abolitionist who said that Frederick Douglass graduated from the peculiar institution of slavery, and his diploma was written on his back. So you go to 1870, and you reference Frederick Douglass. People are going to say, who are you going to believe, some former slave who has no education, or Charles Darwin and a Harvard Medical School professor? Who do you believe? And that's shocking. If you read about the 19th century, how many of these Ivy League professors and academics supported eugenics and all this stuff about brain development that we know today as pseudoscience? How many of them supported oppression of women, slavery? And I think that we lack this historical perspective about how much progress has really happened.
Even recently, Paul points out a generation ago, 4% of Americans approved of interracial marriage, and the most recent numbers, 87%, which, by the way, who are the 13%? I mean, that actually stands out to me for 13%. Don't say that. But regardless, 4% of Americans approving interracial marriage a generation ago, 87% today.
Yeah.
So, you know, the point of all of these conversations about these thought experiments is that Paul wants us to understand that we can be down on the state of progress, and progress, we should not be complacent about it. But when you look historically, it's amazing what has come to bring us to 2017. So to think that we would never be able to achieve a state of warlessness, a state of real peace, you're saying that's wrong.
Yeah. So I'm not saying things are perfect. Things are far from perfect.
Right.
I'm saying that we're on this journey as humans. Maybe we're halfway to the goal. Maybe we're 20% of the way to the goal, but we have made progress. How did those changes happen? And how can we learn from those historical advancements to create more change that's needed today? So we're far from the finish line, far from the goal, but we have made some progress. How did that happen, and how do we use those lessons and strategies and tactics to create more change that is needed today?
All right. I got to get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back and talk more about what he thinks the causes of war are, eliminating those causes. And I want to ask Paul directly, if we were to go 100 years and 500 years into the future, assuming no nuclear annihilation, which, my goodness, we're going to hope that is the case, that there is none, that what are the commonly held beliefs in 2017 that are going to be looked at in the same way that would get a laugh the same way we laughed at this idea that a Harvard medical professor would say that women's ovaries stop developing when they read books. I mean, what are those commonly held beliefs? So we'll ask Paul that, but listeners, I'm curious to know how you feel about that. What are sort of the things that you think, this is going to be sort of embarrassing that this was the case in 2017, and on the way, on the road of progress, how will we feel in the future about that? Can we achieve world peace? How do you feel about the human condition if we are sort of naturally geared toward not just violence but war, as Paul points out, two different things? 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free. 844-295-8255 and 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. After our only break of the hour, we'll get right back to it with Paul, and Kit Miller from the Gandhi Institute will tell you about how you can see him in Rochester tonight. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. A couple of interesting emails on these subjects. I'll get to those in just a second. Kit Miller, why don't you tell us again, if our listeners want to hear Paul's message, they can do that how?
We're going to be tonight at Downtown United Presbyterian Church at 7 o'clock. We'll be starting around 7 o'clock sharp. Paul will be presenting, and then we'll have some time for questions and answer. And I hope people will take advantage of it if your spirits have been lowered of late, if you're worrying about issues of nuclear war, especially given, this is our week where we remember our responsibility for dropping bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. A really good way to spend a couple of hours tonight.
Amy writes to the program and says, Evan, I'm not sure we're going to see religion go away entirely, but I believe in the future we will see more of a society of skeptics and atheists, and to the extent that religion survives, there will be less of a viewpoint that religion is a need to create war, that many people will start to see that they are worshiping the same God. That's from Amy. It's a thought on what future generations might say about religion. I'm curious to know what Paul thinks about that.
Yeah, religion's very interesting. People used the Bible to condone slavery, but most of the people who worked to abolish slavery were very devoted Christians, and they would reference the Bible. So the pro-slavery people would reference the Bible, and the anti-slavery people would reference the Bible. And so many of these social movements, the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement in the 19th century, and the abolition movement, the movement to abolish slavery, a lot of these movements, Gandhi's movement, you look at Archbishop Desmond Tutu in South Africa, they have a religious underpinning. And so religion can go in these drastically different directions. And how do we channel religion more toward this kind of peace work, right? I mean, a very common bumper sticker that I've seen and that people can see all over the country is, who would Jesus bomb? If you look at the views of Jesus or Buddha or many of the religious founders, religion is actually fairly complex, and there are many examples of peacemakers, Nobel Prize winners, who are very religious. So how do we cultivate more of that and create conditions where people are less able to use religion as a way to manipulate people into war?
Liz writes to the program and says, Evan, the answer is easy to this one, racism. And forgive me for not having the optimism, but we still have such inherent racism in our society that I can't imagine a future without it in some way. Heck, we have a president and many people who use overtly racist language every day, and it seems to still be okay in 2017. So I appreciate your guest, but I am not the optimist.
Yeah, I don't consider myself an optimist at all. I think I'm a realist. And I don't know why people were surprised that Donald Trump got elected. It just seems, I don't know. I don't consider myself an optimist. I think that if we look at reality, we see signs of how progress has happened, how we can create more progress. And I think that one reason people get very hopeless is they have this kind of false optimism. None of this really surprises me. These bad things that happen, it really is a question of where do you put your hope. If you put your hope in things that can't be tarnished or destroyed by the wind changing, you have a much stronger place for centeredness and fortitude. And so I try to put my hope in those places that don't involve this kind of false optimism.
But when, on the subject of racism, Liz is seeing a lot that really dismays her today.
Right.
And she's hearing you describe human progress over centuries that I do not in any way want to diminish what Liz, the emailer, is saying.
Yeah.
But I do think it's important occasionally to try to get ourselves out of the exact moment we're in and try to get some historical context, because we risk, if we celebrate all the progress that's been made for centuries, we risk looking callous to the people who are still oppressed, and there's a lot.
Right.
And that's not the intention. But the intention is to say, if you don't believe human progress is possible, look at where we have been and look at where we still can go. So what would you say to Liz in terms of maybe keeping that historical context in mind when she sees the racism of today?
That's a really good point. And she has a wonderful comment. I really appreciate her comment because it's not about, I don't look at the historical perspective to feel good or to get people to feel good. I look at the historical perspective to understand what can we learn from those movements to create more progress today. So the way I write and the way I teach workshops is what lessons and strategies and tactics can we learn from those movements? How do these things actually change? So it's actually looking at the historical perspective to understand how progress actually happened so we can apply those lessons to the modern world. So it's not about looking at history just to feel good, although hope certainly can increase your capacity for action. But it's more so to basically become trained in how to wage peace. When I was in the Army, I saw how people have excellent training in how to wage war, but most people have no training in how to wage peace. And what if people were as well trained in waging peace as soldiers are in waging war? And the military looks at history, it looks at strategies, it looks at tactics, it has training. And what if we were to apply those same things to the mission of peace or the mission of justice in the world today? And so I think that the only way we're going to move forward is if we understand how progress has happened and how we can learn from that and also improve upon past techniques.
All right, let me get another email in, and this is from Neil. He says, I'm interested in how Paul sees technology's role in making war less personal or barbaric. It seems to me drone flyers may be able to distance themselves from the impact more so than a soldier on the ground or in the trenches.
Yeah, so I do a thought experiment in the Chautauqua talk that I can do very quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. Please do.
And this thought experiment, basically, I reference this book On Killing written by Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, where he talks about how it is unnatural for humans to kill other humans. We actually have a natural aversion to killing our own species. And the evidence that we have to support this is all of military history, because in order to wage war, a country must dehumanize people. So I talk about how actually inflicting violence can be traumatic. Not only does kindness not traumatize us, while violence does traumatize us when it's against our will, but the act of inflicting violence can actually traumatize us, even if we receive no physical injury in the process. So I like to do this thought experiment to show how the act of committing violence can traumatize people. So I tell the audience, imagine that I ask you to spend the entire day with a 5-year-old girl, and your mission during this day is to get to know this 5-year-old girl as well as possible. Find out, what does she want to be when she grows up? Does she have a pet? What's her pet's name? What are her parents like? Does she have siblings? What are her siblings like? What's her favorite game? What are her interests, right? What's her favorite food? And then go to the park, spend the entire day getting to know this 5-year-old girl as well as possible. Now, at the end of this day, I want you to look the 5-year-old girl in the eyes, and without blinking or turning your head, I want you to take a hammer and bash her skull in. Around 98% of the human population will become traumatized from inflicting that intimate act of violence. But what if you don't spend the entire day with a 5-year-old girl? What if you know nothing about her and then you kill her? The percentage of people traumatized will decrease slightly. What if you never see her face? What if you hit her in the back of the head with a hammer? The percentage of people traumatized will decrease slightly. What if you don't use a hammer? What if you shoot her with a rifle at 300 yards? The percentage of people traumatized will decrease. What if you believe she's evil, or you believe her family's evil, or you believe her family's subhuman, or you believe that her family wants to kill your family? Percentage of people traumatized goes way down. What if you drop bombs at 10,000 feet? Percentage of people traumatized goes way down. And so the war system is able to create all these forms of distance. Some of these forms of distance are psychological in nature. Some of them are actually in terms of physical separation. And that is able to reduce the amount of people traumatized. Now, the human need to dehumanize people is so common that every culture that wants to kill people does this. The Nazis dehumanize people, the Ku Klux Klan, ISIS, Western governments, when they go to war, they dehumanize people. When somebody wants to kill a gay person, because that person is gay, they will dehumanize the person first. And the purpose of dehumanization is to protect the human mind from guilt and remorse. It allows you to hurt and kill humans without feeling remorseful about it. So if you look at the human condition, we actually have this biological aversion to hurting and killing humans, and dehumanization is needed to suppress that biological aversion.
That, though, makes me more concerned, because what Neil is saying is we're better able to kill without that personal tie.
Absolutely.
Right? With technology.
Yep. Absolutely.
And does that put us more at risk for perpetuating war, because it doesn't feel as traumatizing, it doesn't feel as personal?
Absolutely. The war system is this constantly evolving, adapting system. You make an advancement in moral progress, you make an advancement in empathy, and the war system adapts to it. So now the war system is adapting by using more drone strikes and more mechanization. So yes, he's absolutely right. So which means we have to continue our evolving and adapting to further push the system to where it can no longer harm innocent people.
So when people ask you that broad question, what do you really think the cause of war is? What's the, again, our goal on this program is not to dumb down too much or distill too much.
Right.
But what's the shorthand that you give them for a starter kit for understanding, what do you think the cause of war is?
So that's a very good question. It's a very complex answer. It would be like asking, what's the cause of illness? It depends. It depends on what illness we're talking about. There's many different kinds of war. So what's the cause of illness? There's actually no very simple answer for the cause of illness. There's many different kinds of illness. There's viruses. There's illnesses caused by certain kinds of bacteria. There's illnesses caused by diet, lifestyle. There's all kinds of different illnesses. But here's another way I can frame that question is, imagine if you had a basketball game and nobody was taught how to play basketball. It'd be a mess, and everybody would understand why. Nobody would be surprised. Imagine if you had an orchestra play Beethoven, and nobody was taught how to play their instruments. It would be a mess, and nobody would be shocked by it. People would say, of course, this sounds terrible, because nobody knows how to play their instruments. So we have this world where people are not taught basic peace skills. So why are we so surprised that the world is way more warlike and violent than it needs to be if we're not taught these basic peace skills? As a child, I was never taught how to resolve conflict. I was never taught how to deal with my trauma or how to deal with rage. I was never taught how to calm myself down or calm other people down. I was never taught how to listen with empathy. These basic skills I was never taught. And so we have to recognize that when we have a society or a world that does not have peace literacy, that war and violence are going to be much more likely to erupt. And empathy is a human capacity like language. Children naturally learn language, just naturally, and children naturally start to form empathy at a very young age. But we recognize just because a child naturally learns language, they still have to be taught language, right? We don't just say, well, a three-year-old can speak, let's just leave them be. We teach children language from preschool through college. And people still have a difficult time with language, writing a persuasive essay, because language is very complex. And we spend almost nothing in terms of cultivating people's empathy. What if we put as much emphasis into strengthening the muscle of empathy as we do into the muscle of language? And so much of what we learn in our culture actually suppresses our empathy. So what if we were to prioritize empathy the way that we prioritize language? What if we were to put as much emphasis into teaching peace literacy as we did into math or into literacy and reading and writing? And peace literacy, we need this for a healthy democracy. We're seeing that now. We need this for healthy communities, healthy families, so people can resolve conflict with strangers, roommates, friends, coworkers. We need this for healthy workplaces, and we need this for human survival. And so I think one major cause of the war is lack of peace literacy, just like a major cause of illness is lack of literacy in the nature of illness and what the cures for illness can be. So we have to actually make this an educational movement to really take this seriously.
We go to John in Penfield in just a second. Just want to read a couple of comments on Twitter. One of our listeners says, great show. Progress is not always a straight line, but sometimes a coil, and sometimes it certainly doesn't feel like we are going forward, but we are. Lawrence says, by the way, even Thomas Hobbes, who claimed nature is a constant state of war, thought fear inclines us to seek peace. John in Penfield, next on the phone. Go ahead, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Just a brief comment that I think with media coverage of the actual mayhem and absolute devastation of war, if that was covered and broadly distributed so that people, that the masses would understand how absolutely devastating war is, that is probably the best chance to gain peace, because ultimately all rulers decide, they determine when to go to war and when to end war, and they do their best to shelter the horrific consequences involved in fighting. We kind of romanticize World War II and all these epic battles, but it's actual brutality on an unmatched scale. You think about, we dropped the atomic bomb on innocent people. Why? Because of a military goal, a political goal. So all I'm saying is that if our best chance is to have the media coverage of actual what is occurring on the battlefield, that would turn the tide of public opinion against all these politicians and statesmen that are promoting war for whatever their cause is. Thank you.
Thank you.
John, thank you. What a phone call. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, so every unjust system is based upon a simple myth or series of myths. For example, the oppression of women in the United States was based upon the myth that women are intellectually inferior to men. The slavery system in the U.S. was based upon the myth that African Americans are subhuman. They're born to be slaves and they're happy being slaves. If you do not refute that myth or challenge that myth, you can't make progress. And the war system is based upon three myths. The first is that humans are naturally violent. The second is that war is inevitable. If war is inevitable, then the logical conclusion is to have the most powerful military in human history or be allied with a nation that has a powerful military. Third myth is that war makes us safe. If people believe that war makes them safe, it doesn't matter how much you talk about the military budget, how much you talk about people being killed, people will support war. If people believe that war protects their freedom and their family and their safety and their way of life, the military budget conversation does not affect them. And if you talk about civilian casualties, well, that's what's needed to protect freedom and democracy and our way of life and safety. And so, if you look at all these different systems, and if you look at the war system in particular, we have to think about how do we refute those three myths. And all the – to show how this has happened, this has been – for the past 7 years, a lot of the pressure has been shown on talking about civilian casualties and dead soldiers. And the war system has adapted to that by moving more toward drone strikes and precision strikes and cruise missiles. So the reason why we don't bomb Tokyo or – Dresden the way we did in World War II, or the reason why we don't napalm villages is because there is more public pressure against civilian casualties. But the war system is still there. It's just adapting. So I think that if you do not challenge those three myths, that is the only way to actually undo the system.
To John's point, and I don't remember all the details, so please, listeners, look this up on your own. I'm trying to go from memory here, and I mistake a lot of things. But I recall that the Bush administration didn't even want flag-draped coffins shown.
Right.
And we're not talking about horrific images of what bullets do to the human body or bombs do to the human body. We're talking about a flag-draped coffin that wasn't even allowed to be shown, or at least that was the preference of the government. And what John is saying is I think the opposite, which is that if we want people to fully understand how horrific this is, we have to take the distance away from it. We have to bring people and let them see it. Do you support, Paul, when there is war, journalistic freedom and the publication of images as ghastly as they can be? I mean, I go back to your thought experiment that was hard to even think about, by the way, with that 5-year-old girl. It was hard, and that was a fictional child. It's hard to think about that. Do you support the publication of images that show just how horrific some of these results can be?
Yeah, I think that's very fair and a conscientious thing to do is to show the actual horrors of war. But the thing is, people won't look at it. If people don't want to look at it, or if people are able to turn their head and say, well, that's just a necessary evil. We need this to protect our country. We need this because humans are naturally violent. People just aren't going to look at it. It's you can show people images of what happens to you when you smoke. And people still smoke. You can show images of what happens when you drive drunk, and people still drive drunk. And so there is research that when you show these kinds of horrific images to people, people will either not look at it or it won't have the kind of impact that we're looking for. And so I think that that is something that is very much needed. But I think that if, as long as people believe that war makes them safe and humans are naturally violent and war is inevitable, that those are also needed in combination of also showing the horror and the reality of war.
All right, down to our last 90 seconds then. Give us a little bit of a call to action that you'd like to see more people adopt as we move toward a world without war.
Yeah, I think that we have to change the paradigm. War is actually a symptom of much deeper problems. And I think that we actually get lost in the issue of war or the issue of racism, and we actually don't recognize these deeper underlying problems, which are problems with how we perceive the nature of peace, the nature of war, the nature of humanity, the human condition, and the nature of reality itself. And so many of these racial problems, these problems regarding injustice, war-making, environmental destruction, actually rise out of much deeper problems in the human psyche and human ways of thinking. And I try to really focus on those underlying conditions that cause these other problems to grow and spread.
I mean, the best I can tell, one of the most powerful things we can do is just start by eliminating the idea. The basic assumption is that war is just inevitable.
Right.
That it's just part of us. And Joel writes to the program to say, our government has had a department of war, but not to his knowledge, a department of peace. You want some final thoughts on that?
Yeah, I just want to say one thing, that I really appreciate this, and I just want to remind the audience, it's as if we had 50 minutes to talk about how to speak Chinese, or 50 minutes about how to do calculus, or 50 minutes about how to play baseball. This is a very complex topic, and I really appreciate people's patience. I have more information at my website, peacefulrevolution.com, and I'm speaking again tonight. And thank you so much for having me. I'm very honored and grateful.
No, it's been our pleasure. Peacefulrevolution.com. Much more on Paul and his work. And by the way, I mentioned the presentation he did at Chautauqua. Video's right there. You can share that if you like. Some similar themes and some really relatable ideas that you heard from Paul here. Kit Miller, one more time. Tonight, see Paul where?
7 o'clock, downtown United Presbyterian Church, South Fitzhugh Street, Rochester.
And I'll just say, as the host of the show, this show's not about me or my opinions, but I'm gonna assume that Paul is right. And I'm going to strip away my assumption that war is part of the human condition, and that's a choice that we make, or at least it's a part of a complex structure that doesn't have to exist. Thank you. Thanks for being here.
Thank
Paul
you.
Chappelle, Kit Miller from the Gandhi Institute. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer of this broadcast. Catch Wars is always nice to see behind the glass there. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice and a peaceful afternoon. We will talk to you Thursday on Member Supported Public Radio.